You're listening to episode 23 of the College of Mythic Cartography podcast with me, Willem Larson, recorded on March 3rd, 2009. In this episode, I speak with Evan Gardner, the developer of the language fluency game Where Are Your Keys, and, as you'll discover in the interview, much, much more. I do want to note one thing, that we only had one microphone to pass back and forth, so I'll hope you accommodate us as we dance through the interview. So I'm here talking with Evan Gardner, the masterful and genius mind behind the language fluency game known as Where Are Your Keys. It's good to have you here, Evan.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Will.
So, without further ado, we've been planning this podcast for months now, and then you skipped out of last week, so claiming a busy schedule. So I'm glad we're really cracking into this, and why don't we just start with the history of Where Are Your Keys? I guess I'll also ask you to give a very, very brief description of the game itself, just in case folks who are listening to this podcast don't know about the game. So give me like a 30-second description, if you would.
Well, it's a language game that basically allows people to know exactly what everybody else is talking about right from the very beginning. There's no curveballs. There's no surprises. Everybody is playing this game in order to get fluent in a language. And so there's never any guessing and tripping over stuff. Everything is laid out right from the beginning, from the very simplest, with a clear goal of where people are trying to go in a target language. Let's say you're trying to learn Chinese. Well, where do you start? Where should you be after a little while? Where are you going to end up? And how can you ask questions that get you the most bang for your studying buck? How long does it take? You know, some people say, like, it takes 1,500 hours of study time, seat time, in order to learn a language. What if that could be done in an hour less? Well, of course you're going to take that. Well, what if it could be done in half the time? Well, what if it could be done in a quarter of the time? I don't know how fast it could be done. And I'm really interested in 10 years when everybody has this game and everybody is working this game. I'm really curious to see what that time actually gets down to for Chinese. I mean, theoretically, it could get down to, you know, a couple hours, depending on what you need the language to do for you. You get parachuted into China. How long does it take you to get a meal, a hotel, and a car? An hour of playing this game with your waiter while you're sussing out the situation that you're in? Maybe two. Might need to order dinner. But, you know, really, it doesn't, there's no reason that it's going to take, you know, a year's worth of university study. That's just ridiculous. So people don't have that kind of time. And so how do we speed it up?
Nice. That was way longer than 30 seconds. This is why. You know, I listening to you talk, I was reminded of where we first met. Actually, we met first in two places. We met in passing at the first Rewild camp that Urban Scout ever put on in the Portland, Oregon area. What is that? Colonel Summers Park. That was pretty cool. And I had no idea who you were, but I remember meeting you. And then the next time we met at the Grand Ron Tribal Office on Kelly Avenue, I think, in Portland.
Southwest Kelly.
And you were teaching Chinook Wawa. Mm-hmm. And I remember you, for one of your students, had really embraced it. And what was his name? Justin, mm-hmm. Right? And is now a fluent teacher of that language. And 15 years old. And the funny thing, like, as soon as I started engaging with the game,
I knew there was like magic going on. And I've discovered this is a fairly common phenomenon for anybody that truly loves language learning and has no reason to be threatened by new ideas of language learning. Wear Your Keys is a revelation. I mean, it's like, it's a joyful experience. And what I haven't heard to this day is the story of it, how it came to be. And I think that's, for me, that's really what I've been curious about for a long time. And stories are a big deal to me anyway. And so maybe that's why I'm obsessed with this. But it just blows my mind that you came up with this game. And I just need to know. I got to know where did it start? You know? And what happened along the way?
Well, it started about seven... Wait, no, it'd be about 9 years ago now. This is 2009. It started in about 2001. I'll tell you a little funny story about kind of where it ended up after about 3 years of me developing it. I went to a tribal office, and I shopped it to them. And there was a university professor there who I showed the game to. It takes about an hour, and we just did it in sign language. And after about an hour and a half or so, she could easily beg, borrow, or steal. That's one of the tricks that, you know, if I have a black pen and you have a jar of iced tea, can you talk me out of my black pen using this target language? And in about an hour, hour and a half, she could easily have, you know, gotten anything that I had, paid for it, borrowed it, stolen it, in you know, really good sign language. After the game was over, I said, so what do you think? And she said, and I quote, "Well, Evan, I'm really surprised that for someone of your lack of education, you could come up with something so clever." That's my sort of quintessential moment that said that I had something. Wasn't sure what it was, but I had something. And I was really kind of mad. And then the next day I thought of, you know, of course the perfect comeback is I'm just, you know, amazed that someone of your incredible education that you didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sort of where it sort of ended up after a couple of years. So where it started, I was in a hotel room in David, Panama, in the jungle. Where I was down to about $15, 20 years old. I've been traveling for about a year by then. I was in my hotel room, and I realized that I could die. And the people in that hotel room, like if some sort of tropical spider bit me or something, I could die. The people in that own the hotel, they would have just drugged me out into the jungle. There would have been no phone call home. There would have been no, like, you know, investigation. The State Department would have never called my parents. It would have just been sort of this, like, lost in the jungle, dude, whatever. So
how old were you?
I was 20 years old. 20 years old. And just in this hotel room, just this concrete wall, flea-bitten mattress. It was like a $3 hotel. And I started crying because I was like, what am I doing with my life if I can just be absorbed into the jungle with no phone call, with no care? They probably would have sold my passport for, you know, $100 or whatever, gone through my pockets, looked for loose change. And not because I was a bad person, just because I was, well, what the heck was I doing there? So right then, what am I doing with my life? And so I thought to myself, I could be a teacher. I have some experiences. I'll be a teacher. So right then, at that moment, in David, Panama, I'm like, I'm going to be a teacher. Okay. So I kind of pulled myself together, stopped crying, and I'm like, okay, how can I do this? And it wasn't like a cry of like desperation. It was just a cry of just sort of like, what am I doing? And so I kind of pulled myself together, and I said, okay, if you're going to be a teacher, what do you have to do? What are the concrete steps I got to start? Right now is a good time. So I said, okay, well, I need to go to university in order to do that. I can go to university anywhere in the world, but it would probably be easier if I went in the United States. And a degree from either the United States or Europe or Australia carries more weight than, say, a university degree from Panama, which would have probably cost me about $3,000 or $4,000 just in a day. So I decided to start heading back to the United States, to Oregon. And so I did, started heading back. I decided I would take 2 years of community college just to see how I liked it. And while I was there, still with this idea that I wanted to be a teacher, what ended up happening was that I noticed that teachers were using the same tricks. They were using the same techniques. Know it or not, they were doing the same things to get information across. I didn't know what I wanted to teach at the time, but I knew I wanted to be a teacher. So I started thinking to myself, there are universal teaching methods. There are tricks that work, and everyone is employing them, from the chemistry teacher to the math teacher to the language teacher. And so what I started doing was I actually started taking notes when I was in class. I had sort of two notebooks going, and when I didn't have a second notebook, it was just the edge of one notebook. I would take notes on the actual class material being taught, and then I would also keep notes on the specific teaching techniques that they were using. And I didn't know the names of these techniques. I was just kind of making up names as I went along, just kind of keeping track of what everybody was kind of doing, looking around the classroom and seeing what was working and what wasn't and trying to adapt that, basically stealing as many techniques as I could get my hands on. I figured that's why I was in college. I was going to be a teacher. Everyone who's teaching me is doing it in a particular method. I will use that. As I keep going, I had a real lack of specific teaching methodology instruction. I was having a hard time even talking with people at different universities. I got a job in the education department, computer lab, where all these master's and teaching students were coming into the computer lab all day long. And I'd say, hey, can I look at your books? What kinds of things are they teaching you guys? And, you know, I found that from all the different teaching universities, in Oregon anyway, master's and teaching programs, they weren't actually being taught how to teach. They were being taught classroom management, some curriculum design, but they weren't actually being taught, this is information, here's a technique that works, that moves it from one human to the other. And so what I started thinking was, okay, how do I unify these techniques in my own self so that I can teach something? And I still hadn't decided what. Everybody's kind of hounding on me like, okay, what are you going to teach? Well, I don't know yet. What about just teaching? What about the idea, this art of moving information from one mind to the other? Eventually, I settled on Spanish to teach Spanish. I spoke Spanish, and I went to the university department, master's in teaching program, and I said, so what's the easiest program to get into? I said, so, you know, I was really interested in astronomy. Oh, well, for every 6 slots that we have about 150 applicants. I'm like, I'm not getting into that. Like, even if I can, I just don't want the competition. Because I also knew that if I just got a teaching certificate to teach at high school, I could always go back and get a secondary endorsement. So really, what's the easiest track to get the piece of paper? I said, so what about English? She said, well, you know, 150 applicants. Oh, God. What about math? 125. Jeez. Okay. What is the least number of applicants you have for these 6 seats that you have in your master's programs? And she said, Spanish. I said, really? For 6 seats, we had 2 applicants last year. And I said, well, I found my gig. So here we go. So I decided to be a Spanish teacher. In that sort of, that was for Bachelor of Arts. So I was starting to fish around for master's programs then.
Yeah.
I started getting involved with Native Studies, Native American Studies. I took a Native American Studies class at Southern Oregon University, Dave West and Brent Florendo. And all this time, I'd been planning on being a Spanish teacher. So I've done a lot of practicums. I've done a lot of tutoring, a lot of teaching. I had a mentor teacher a long time ago tell me that if I was interested in being a teacher, to learn special ed, because then nothing would faze me. And so I spent a lot of time in special ed. Nothing fazes me.
Yeah.
I walk in, I say, wear the gloves, and we go to work. just like I said, keep them in my pocket, you know, just in case. But that's been a good habit. Anyway, so what ended up happening was that I went to this conference for this Native Studies class, and it was a Revitalizing Native Languages at OSU in Corvallis. And all of a sudden, there were all these natives who spoke their native languages. Now, I haven't been living under a rock, but I grew up in Portland, Clackamas, Molalla, Oregon, so along the Willamette River. And I did a lot of good growing up on the Molalla River that goes into the Willamette River just above Oregon City Falls at Canby. And everybody that I had been talking to my whole life, I was, hey, where are the Indians? Aren't there supposed to be some Indians here? Like, I'm a little kid, you know, playing in the river, and no Indians. And they always said, oh, they're all dead. And, you know, I believed them.
Yeah.
But I haven't been living under a rock. And so I'm just like, well, where are they? And just there's just no sort of interface, no information, and just no one really talking about it. So I'm sitting here at this conference. All of a sudden, there's Indians everywhere. All of a sudden, there's Indians speaking their languages. And they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying, we need help revitalizing our languages. We need to have a way to keep our languages strong. And I'm sitting there thinking, I have by now developed some really good tricks for Spanish. And then I thought to myself, Spanish is doing fine. Yeah. They don't need me. They're going to be okay. Spanish will live. And they're all saying, well, there's six of us left. There's six of us who speak this language. There's 10 of us. There's 50 of us. And I'm just, that's just not enough. That's not enough. Right then, I realized there was a problem.
How many years ago was this?
This was 2001.
Oh.
2001.
Okay.
So a couple years ago. A couple years. I've been plugging away at this for a while.
Yeah.
So the thing I realized was that I have a degree in Spanish, a bachelor's in Spanish. So I can get a master's in teaching Spanish, and I can get an endorsement to go teach Spanish at a high school. And I can also teach Spanish at like a college or something like that. So they can get degrees and they can go back to some community, maybe their home community, and teach Spanish in the high school and get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem that everybody seems to be having, is that you can't get any coursework in the university in your native language. So you're never going to get a degree in, you're never going to get a degree in, Kicsh or some other local native language. Kalapuya, it's pretty much gone, but you can't get a degree in that, which means you're never going to be able to get a teaching certificate with a bachelor's in that language. So you're never going to be able to go back to your home community and get a job teaching your language. So of course, why would you even spend the time learning that language if you're not going to get a job? It's not going to help you financially. Why go through the effort? So I started thinking, okay, well, that's the first issue, is that we have to have a way in universities of giving credit for people who speak their native language. And what happened was is that everybody kept saying, well, yeah, we need that, we need that, we need that. There's this real sort of worry that universities were going to come, steal the language and the test, and make the Indian community spiel all of their language detail and then sort of steal it.
Gosh, I wonder why they...
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nothing like history to prove you right.
Yeah.
So there's a funny story there. Like, we're producing all these linguists in universities. Like, every university has a linguistics department.
Yeah.
Every year we're graduating, 10, 20 linguistics graduates.
Yeah.
If we're doing such a great job, why are these languages dying? Globally, why are these languages dying? I'm just talking about Oregon universities. We probably have 100 graduates a year, maybe 200 graduates a year in linguistics. That's Oregon. We've got 50 states. So we're looking at 50,000 graduates a year in linguistics, or 5,000, depending on the math. And then why are their languages still dying? We've trained linguists. I'm thinking to myself, there's a problem here. We're not concentrating on teaching language. We're concentrating on getting this stuff, writing it down on paper in this linguistic hieroglyphic, taking it back to the university. It sits on a shelf as somebody's thesis, and it never gets looked at again. I had a woman come to me after I did a presentation. She pulled out this thick book, and she handed it to me. She said, "Can you read this?" And I flipped it open, and it's all linguistic alphabet, not international phonetic alphabet, but an earlier system. And I can't quite read it. I can read some of it, but I'm not professional in that. And I'm just like, no, I can't. And she's, well, this is my mom. And a linguist came to our community, sat with her for a couple years, wrote all this stuff down, took it back to the university, and I can't read it. None of my family members can read it. She's dead now. So we don't know what this all says.
Right.
So there's, and I'm just like, That's a tragedy that we have these linguists who are going to communities saying, I can help, sitting with grandma for her last couple of years, writing this stuff down in a language and not taking the time to educate the people in the family group what's happening, and the language, we use up that person's last years for a book that sits on a shelf that nobody can read.
Yes.
And that's great for people and linguists to come back and look at 50 years later. That's interesting. Isn't it more interesting if we could also have a living speaker, at the same time that they're looking at those books. That makes things a lot better, just in general. So I realized, sitting there at this conference, so the big problem, we're not having university credit. There's no way to get credit for your language. Second problem, an elder may not know how to teach. And so it starts becoming the student's responsibility to pull the language out of a person instead of the elder's responsibility of pushing the language on a person. And I realized that the thing that we don't have is a very simple, very easy game-style conversation that everybody can just get in on without books, because everybody's all distracted by curriculum. Well, we need a dollar for curriculum and computers and books and notebooks and all this stuff. You don't need any of that. We haven't needed that until about the last 100 years. Before that, people learned languages just fine.
We got stupider.
So there's no reason to do that. So I started thinking, okay, there's got to be a way that a game that's a universal game, that's super simple, that's completely transferable to a person. It has to be a game that's fast, that a person could explain in just a couple of minutes, that everybody could just start playing. And then as it goes along, it develops more thick and more useful games in the specific language that it's dealing with. Right. So what is this little trick? So I started thinking to myself, the other problem that we're having is that if we're lucky, we get a kid who's interested enough in their language, who has the opportunity to hang out with an elder who actually speaks it, who's clever enough to teach it so that the student can pick it up. So we got this kid who's an actual speaker. Oh my God, we get really lucky like that once in a while. What if that person is stage fright? Can't teach? Well, we're sort of in the same basket. So how do we go about hedging our bets so that every time that we are teaching a lesson, we're building that student into a teacher, almost more importantly than we're building that person into a fluent speaker? They become fluent at the same time they become really good, agile teachers. Their fluency builds as their teaching skills build. Okay, that's where we need to go. The university thing, that's an issue, but more importantly, we need to have some sort of way of creating teachers, not speakers. So I went back to to school, thinking to myself, how can I use all of these techniques that I have as a Spanish teacher to help native languages? While I was there at Southern Oregon University, talked to the dean of languages, dean of foreign languages, and convinced him that we need to have a way to universally identify what level a student is at. In comes ACTFL, American Council on Teaching Foreign Languages. They have already an assessment tool that can be applied to every language based on your ability to have a conversation. Nothing written, just can you talk? And to what ability can you talk? Can you say just words, just random sort of words that you memorized? Can you say sentences? Can you get your point across? Can you make it to a party on time, dressed appropriately, bringing the right food? Can you tell me a story about the best day of your life? Kind of Larry King style. And can you, at the superior end of it, if you're super proficient, can we have a Charlie Rose style conversation where we're really talking about the social, economical, political system of the world that we're living in and how that affects us? So I said, okay, so this system, this university calibrated system applies to all languages? Yes. You can get the training in English for people who are coming over from different countries. So you can apply this to English, but once you understand the concept in English, you can apply it to any other language on the planet. There's only a few little tricks to it, but basically for the intermediate mid-standing, to get your university Bachelor of Arts requirement met, you need to be able to have a Big Bird-style conversation like Sesame Street, or an amount of language that gets you to the party. You know, whose party, when is the party, where is the party, what should you bring, how do I get there, what time is it going to start, all those big sort of question words. If you can do that, you have your Bachelor of Arts second language requirement met. So that means that you don't have to now go to college and take Spanish. You can use your native language. So now, how do we convince elders of these language communities that this system works. And it's not a system that the university is going to steal. It's a test that they administer. It's a system that they are in complete control over. And then the university actually asks them, so what is this student's proficiency level? They write a letter. It says this student has an intermediate mid proficiency level. Thank you very much. They take that letter to the university. They get credit. They never have to take Spanish, French, Russian, some of the language that they may or may not use back in their home community. But really, what's the most important language? Theirs.
Yeah.
And that's probably dying, right. Generally. It's hard to not say that about almost every language on the planet, really, besides about 10. So I started thinking, okay, this game, there's got to be a game. There's got to be a really easy way to get this across. So I graduated. I got a job at the Social Security office, moved to Roseburg, Oregon. Took a second job, and I met a guy named Bryce Folger, who was deaf. And I took some sign language back in college, just a regular, you know, classic sign language style class. And I knew that just talking about language isn't enough. You actually have to move a language from one person to another while you talk about these techniques, or else it just gets kind of lost in theory. You have to actually be able to exchange the language while you're speaking about it, and then slip the techniques in there, almost guerrilla style, until the student really has some buy-in, so then you can start just talking about these language terms really clearly. Where are your keys, obviously. Two words, same sentence, that kind of thing. So you have these little tricks, these technique names, so that you have a common language about what you're doing. So I said to him, because what I did when I taught Spanish was I realized that using sign language at the same time really helped people. Being able to point to yourself when you want them to say yo, you know, just giving these really quick and simple signs. And then I started thinking, well, why not learn all of sign language? Because then I could hint even to more difficult concepts, because we could simultaneously sign language at the same time that you can speak any other language on the planet. If both of you share sign language, it doesn't matter what's coming out of your mouth. You automatically understand because you can see the language happening in front of you. Sign language is the only language that you can actually, you know, have that kind of dual language conversation. And so I thought, okay, well, this could be a vehicle for teaching people how to learn other languages. Luckily, sign language is a really simple language, so it's going to be a faster language to convey these techniques as, say, Chinese. You know, really a different structure than anything. So if you just have this simple sign language, how do you do it? So I started talking to Bryce Folger. I said, look, if I give you $100, will you let me live on your couch? And he said, okay.
That's cheap.
It was. It was. So he let me live on his couch because I needed to be immersed in sign language first to get a handle on what this game could be. So I'm looking now specifically for a language teaching game, a language teaching tool that creates teachers, not that creates fluent speakers. And so, you know, first teacher, fluent speaker second. If you can teach a person how to get the language, they will make themselves fluent. They'll put themselves in situations that they can get fluent on their own. So I said to Bryce, so how can you teach me sign language? And he says, well, you know, I've taught some people before. They usually end up dropping out because they get bored. It takes too long, all this kind of thing. I said, look, I will teach you how to teach languages if you teach me sign language. And he says, okay, deal. An interesting thing happens in deaf communities and in deaf culture in that a lot of deaf kids, their families don't speak sign language. Their parents don't speak sign language, which it amazes me.
Right.
But it happens.
Right.
So I said to him, okay, if you teach me sign language, I will teach you how to teach your family sign language. He says, okay. So we started. And we started developing this game because we just started playing this thing together, and I knew where it was going. I knew where I wanted it to go. He didn't really know where it was going until we started kind of falling into a pattern. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for this little pattern. And we ended up pulling stuff out of our pockets, laying it out on the table and playing this. What is that? Those are my keys. Whose keys are those? Oh, those are my keys. Do you have your keys? Yes, I have my keys. Do you want your keys? yes, I want my keys, to be able to identify the items, to know whose they are, and then to start doing something with that item that goes right into the conversation. We started coming up with this technique called obviously. And that technique really works great because it eliminates all the guesswork. You pull a set of keys out of your pocket, you hold them out, and you say, what are these? Everybody in the room already knows that they're keys. So now they just have to start searching for the right words to use. Everybody also knows they came out of my pocket, so they're clearly mine. So someone, I could pull these keys out of my pocket, and I could say, what are these? And everybody in the room is going to say, those are keys. And I'm going to say, well, whose keys are these? And everybody in the room is going to say, those are your keys. And now we just have to work on the accent and, you know, the tonal placement and the stress. And we can really get specific how we're teaching really fast because everybody knows everything that's going on. So Bryce and I took this sort of to the next level. I also saw a presentation down at Southern Oregon University by a Karuk speaker, Redwood Country, Terry Sapahan, and his wife, who talked about this total physical response. Thought it was a great thing. Like, you hold up a rock, you say, what is this? Everybody says, it's a rock. And you start handing this rock back and forth, talking about this rock. Well, so we took that to the, kind of the next level. So the things that were coming out of our pockets were actual physical items. We start trading them back and forth as quickly as possible so we can get basic needs met. Like, what is that? That's a pen. Oh, I need a pen. Give me your pen. Oh, here you go. Here's my pen. So you can start engaging in conversations with the taxi driver, the hotel clerk, the restaurant server, everyone that you would come in contact with as you walk around. So Bryce and I start playing this as part of the game. We start setting up a situation where we're going to have a lot of simple conversation really quickly. What ended up happening was that he would go home for the weekend and I would say, hey, did you play the game with any of your family members? He'd say, oh yeah, I played it with my brother. It's like, okay, so how far did he get? And we already knew that if we played the game in the same pattern, that I could ask him very specific questions about how far a person got in the language just by throwing out this game. What is that? It's a red pen. Is it your red pen? Yes, it's my red pen. Do you like your red pen? No, I don't like my red pen. Do you want your red pen? No, I don't want my red pen. Will you give me your red pen? Yes, I'll give you my red pen. And so we can trade, borrow, steal it. How many red pens do you have? Where is your red pen? And all this, it came down to where are your keys, which the name kind of stuck.
Yeah.
Because it was this thing that everybody says over and over again. Hey, where are my keys? Where are my keys? Where are my keys? Where are my keys?
Yeah, people are always losing their keys.
They are. They're always losing them, and they're always asking each other, where are my keys?
Yeah.
And so that just became a real easy way to call the game. So that's the game name. That's where that came from, just where are your keys? It got a lot faster to talk about. So what we started doing was we started naming these little techniques. Obviously, where are your keys? Two words, same sentence. Universities have very technical names for all these techniques. A lot of these aren't things that I've thought of. The thing that I have really thought of is how to combine them. So you're layering techniques. So you're not just doing total physical response. I've seen people do that in language classrooms. It works well. It would work even better if all of the students were really in on the technique, what it was supposed to do,
right,
how to use it well. So now not only you're a teacher of the language, but your students are all teachers absorbing this language.
Yeah.
So they're able to ask you questions that are so much more intricate, so much more specific in a way that allows the conversation to just keep rolling. So no books, no curriculum, just conversation. How do we meld this language learning into casual conversation?
Yeah.
So that we teach these students how to pull the language out of an elder. Someone who's not really interested maybe in talking. Someone who isn't interested maybe in carrying on their language. May have some shame associated with it. You know, history of terror associated with their language. So how do we get the student to pull the language out of them without them even knowing it really? While they're having dinner, while they're washing dishes, while they're washing the car, how do you set up conversations so that the language just starts flowing, but in a way that the student is able to capture it, store it, and recall it to other members of the family who may not have had the chance to be there at dinner that night?
Yeah.
How do we build this filing system so that it's a really easily reproducible game to everyone. So Bryce and I, we keep going along, and we grab guinea pigs, our friends, his family, people who were just, you know, hanging out that night. We say, hey, can we play a game? And they were always like, okay. And so within about an hour, we had them signing, right? They're sitting there playing this little game. They're walking away with a language under their belt. You know, they're just kind of, they walk out the room just like, what just happened to me? And we're just,
you couldn't say, come over here and take a sign language class.
No.
You wouldn't get any
We just had to say, can we play this little game with us?
Yeah.
And we would have to say something like, you know, hey, I'm working on this thing.
Yeah.
Help me out, will you? I need a volunteer. And so they would come over, and really, they would sort of walk out of the room in sort of a daze, like, I just learned a language. And we're like, yeah, you did. Tell me about that. You know? They go, what do I do now? And we're like, I don't know.
It's your problem now. It's your burden to bear.
Now you're one of us. So that was kind of a fun experimental phase. And
yeah.
I don't know how many people we ran through that, 100 easily. Just you know, lots of hours, just countless hours of refining these tricks. He would go off. He'd come back to me and say, hey, Evan, I got a trick. I got a technique. I would go off. I'd figure something out. Hey, Bryce, I got a technique. Let me try it on you. And we'd be looking for these guinea pigs to try out these techniques on. We started writing them down. We started numbering them. And then at about 70 techniques or so, we both really felt like we were starting to get something. And the game was progressing to the point where we knew exactly what was going on. And so now I felt completely comfortable with taking this game and shopping it to languages that were dying. And so that's what I did. I took it to Grand Ron. And they said, okay, sounds good. We'll give you a shot. So I told them specifically that I was not going to take Chinook Wawa, Chinook Jargon. I was not going to take it for myself. I wasn't going to produce books and sell them. Everything that I produced, as far as curriculum-wise, was their property, and that I was not going to, you know, take any of the language for myself for personal benefit. And that was really important to me to set up that kind of a confidence between us, just because of the history of linguists coming, saying
right.
that they're going to do this,
right.
and then producing a product that was not able to benefit the language
right.
specifically.
Right.
So my whole idea is to produce teachers of the language. It's not necessarily to produce specific curriculum. Like that's not my job, to produce worksheets and things like that.
Right,
that comes along with it. My job is to train the students to produce worksheets of their own,
yeah.
to produce videos, to produce worksheets, workbooks, curriculum. They can do that for themselves. If you have a whole cadre of teachers all of a sudden, mm-hmm. they have that in their heads. The Wear Your Keys game allows people who experience this for, you know, 1 or 2 hours, they have a walking curriculum in their mind, a walking curriculum for every language on the planet. It's a universal system, a universal game that they can play with anyone, from the taxi driver to the president of the country. And my specific hope was that once they learn this game, they wouldn't just try to learn the language from the taxi driver. They would go find a tutor in China, say, show the Chinese tutor in China this game. The Chinese tutor is going to go, oh, of course, duh, and play this game with them. That's actually one of the problems of this game. It's actually a little bit too simple.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's so quick. It's so fast
yeah.
that anyone who sees this goes, well, of course. And it's almost like we're not doing anything special.
Yeah, right.
That's kind of the problem. I know. Yeah, <that's it. laughs>
yeah.
I know I'm not doing anything special. The thing is that nobody else is combining all of these different ideas into this simple conversation, simple game, simple just tit for tat, back and forth, question and answer situation. They're just not doing that. They think they need to go to the classroom to learn a language. And that's really about the last place that you should go to learn a language, especially if you're starting. So it's kind of developed from there. And then after I learned Chinook Jargon, and I'm sitting there in this class down in Grand Ron. That's Grand Ron, Oregon, Spirit Mountain Casino, on highway, what is that, 18, going towards the coast?
I think it's Highway 18. Anyway, so I was going down there. I was taking, you know, sick leave off from my job at the Social Security office in Roseburg, going down there to attend their monthly or their weekly Monday night class. After a couple months, they all looked at me, everybody there in the class, and they were like, "We've been doing this for 3 years. How did you learn this so fast?" And I said, "I have a trick." And they said, "Oh, we're not interested." It was really funny. Like, the people in the class sitting right next to me, I was like, "Here, let me show you this trick." "Oh, no. And I'm like, okay. I'm to this day confused about that, because it seems like people are somehow worried that I'm going to do something to them. And I'm just like, no. Look, I'll pull this thing out of my pocket, my keys. We'll talk about them for a minute, and then you'll see what questions you need to ask in order to get yourself fluent. Here's a universal curriculum. Want it? Oh, it takes about an hour. And you learn sign language with it. Oh, really? I get a language and a universal curriculum? Yes. and then for some reason, I don't know, people weren't interested. It really shocked me. So anyway, after a couple months, learned a good chunk of the language, and then I took it on myself. Found a guy, Henry Zenk, and I basically pestered him to teach me enough of the language to get myself up and fluent. We went on walks. We went out to lunch. We started writing this curriculum. I was doing it more just for practice, and then got a job there at the Grandin office in Portland teaching. And I went in with that same motivation of not producing speakers, but producing fluent speakers who also were experienced teachers. So we had a family started coming. One of the kids, Justin, was about 12 at the time, 12, 13. And so he kept coming. We started bribing him with money to keep coming. And we basically said, look, you're a teacher now. And we started forcing him into funny positions, not like the inappropriate ones, just like, okay, look, this is your student. And he kind of looking at a starry-eyed, what am I supposed to do with this guy?
I was one of those people.
exactly. But you were one of the people who came in. He probably taught about 10 or 15 new students before you.
Wow.
Yeah. So when you were having your session with him, what I would do is for the first couple of sessions, I was there to help him, to kind of coach him along.
Yeah.
After a little while, I realized that what he needed was to suffer. He needed to get put in positions that he didn't understand how to get out of.
Yeah.
And he needed to come up with teaching techniques of his own.
Yeah.
So by now he has, 30, 40 techniques in his pocket. Now he has to figure out how to use them.
Yeah.
So he has to get kind of stuck in this position where, okay, I got to do something now. This person is kind of taking me on a little funny jog. How do I keep this on track? How do I get the information across? So what I ended up doing is I had to leave. Okay, you're stuck now.
Yeah.
And so being stuck, he came up with some clever tricks that I would never even thought of.
Yeah.
So I let him alone. I let him alone for a couple of weeks to teach new people as they were kind of cycling through. The nice thing about this game is that when Justin gets done talking to someone, they come into the room and I can basically ask him the exact same questions that Justin just got done teaching him.
Yeah.
So he gets this instant review, nothing new. Everything's in the same pattern. Everyone's playing the same game.
Yeah.
At the same tempo, same game. The conversations are slightly different between the different people, but basically it's the same thing over and over. And that's really where people learn languages, is this same thing happening in a slightly different way. The same conversation, minute differences, so that they can compare the differences in their mind. So a student comes out, I can ask them, the same question Justin just got done teaching them, and then the person feels great. They're like, oh my God, I was in there for an hour, and I can, look at all this information. I can walk back, and I can have some kind of conversation with Evan.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, you can. That took an hour. Maybe two. Okay, great. Now we can actually engage in conversation. You have a working knowledge of the language now. Now we don't have to talk about the language in English. We can just work in the language. So when you came around, what I wanted to do with him, with Justin, was I wanted to just make sure that he was still right on track. I didn't know how he was doing it, but people were coming out of the room able to talk after an hour, after an hour and a half, 2 hours. So I wanted to see what he was doing. So when he came to you, when it was your turn, I said, okay, you two. And I sat there and I kind of took notes. And really doing it this way, a student gets used to teaching. They get used to learning by teaching. They get used to being put in positions that they don't know what to do, vocabulary that they don't understand. And then they can ask me very specific questions now. Now I have a student who is an informed student, who is a technically savvy student, who can ask me very specific technical questions. And I'm not fishing around for what the student does and doesn't know. I have to guess. And halfway through, the kid's like, oh, I already know that.
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell me in the first place? That was a half hour wasted.
Right,
so, but
right.
If the student comes to me and it's a student-led conversation, I can give the student exactly what they need, when they need it, based on what the student is asking me.
Yeah.
The student knows what information they need to have conversations they like.
Yeah.
There's a student in another class who's a pilot. I am not a pilot. If he wants to know words that he's going to use all the time with him and his pilot buddies, he is going to have to lead the conversation in order for me to give him that vocabulary.
Yeah.
I'm going to give him vocabulary about cooking and
yeah.
swimming.
Yeah.
That's what I like to do, but you know, he doesn't like to swim, so that vocabulary is useless to him. So there's a lot of saved time if I can get the student on board with playing this game with me. That way they are informing newer students the general concepts. They come to me with more specific questions about how to get their vocabulary up, and then I can kind of oversee the entire working of the whole group. I'm more of a teacher manager than a language teacher.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the position that I want everybody in. I want everybody in the world in that position.
Right.
So that they can teach their kids thousands of languages. There's
yeah.
no reason why we're in this sort of idea, well, I didn't learn that in high school. I didn't go to Spanish in high school.
Right.
Well, why didn't your parents teach you how to pull languages out of people
yeah.
when you were 6, 7, 8?
Yeah.
So that while you were playing with your playground buddies, you didn't pick up Vietnamese, Chinese, Spanish, Honduran Spanish,
yeah.
and Swahili.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't that happen?
Yeah.
And I think it's because they don't have this game. They don't have a quick, easy game that the kid thinks that mom and dad are playing with him. Well, they are.
Yeah.
And that's really the trick, is that it's this fun game. It's this conversation we're having. It's none of this, I mean, God, the classic TV, you know, teacher in front of the classroom, teacher says, get out the books. And all the students say, oh, you know, there's, I don't know, that iconic
yeah.
image of
yeah,
like
right,
irritated
right.
high school kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So why not just engage them in a conversation,
yeah.
which happens to be the exact same format as the ACTful proficiency test.
Yeah.
You engage them in a casual conversation.
Right.
Yeah. And that's actually not coincidental. When I found out about ACTful and how that system worked, I started designing this game to go parallel with that system.
Yeah.
So that by the time a student was able to have a conversation with me, I could, A, really easily tell what level they were at.
Yeah.
Everybody else who had training in ACTful could tell exactly where that student was at.
Yeah.
And the student themselves know exactly where they're at.
Yeah.
It's a self testing system. So they know exactly what they're supposed to do with themselves in order to get themselves to the next level. They know what the next level is.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference in language. I didn't find out about ACTful until after I had a degree in Spanish. I find that happens all the time. I talk to people in languages, language students.
How old is ACTful?
You know, I think it's a State Department design. I think it's from the 50s when they were trying to send diplomats to different places.
Yeah.
If their finger's going to be on the button, they need to have a superior language ability.
I've got a copy. This is something that's going on right now that, for example, with agile teamwork, with open space technology, with all these sort of changing our paradigms of how we learn, how we communicate, how we make decisions, how we collaborate. What sometimes the complaint is, yeah, but we've known about this kind of thing for a long time. Or, yeah, why are you acting like, you know, agile is so new? These are just team techniques that we were using in the 70s. It's like, yes. You're exactly.
Yeah.
They work. And what all we're doing actually anymore is changing the way we put them all together. Like now what is emerging is the wholeness of how we carry the techniques, you know, the system of interaction. Because, yeah, you know, there's been so much water under the bridge, so much interaction in the business world and the social world and in the political world. Like, we know what works, you know, NLP and nonviolent community, you know, all these things have been around for so long. And it's now it's really like, how do we integrate them, you know? And to the point where, like, you were telling me the other day that you think someone could take "Where Are Your Keys" and apply that to bicycle mechanics.
They need to. It behooves them, mm-hmm, as bicycle mechanics to take "Where Are Your Keys,"
yeah,
or, like I like to say it, "Whack."
Yeah.
I didn't mean to do that acronym. It just turned out that way.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting for the day when people take that personal responsibility on themselves,
yeah,
to teach themselves everything about their business that they possibly can.
Yeah.
And to every one of their fellow employees or the employees that they are supervising, they should be versed in these not team techniques, "Where Are Your Keys" techniques, language techniques, so that they can take their bicycle mechanicness to a masterful level,
yeah,
so that they can just communicate with each other on this clear and concise basis. Everyone in a company can now communicate using this same language, even if it's English, but they can set up their conversations in a way that allows an information transfer that really could, should, and will revolutionize the way that people do business in the world. You have this ability to, you know, pull information out of your bicycle mechanic supervisor through a casual conversation. This bicycle mechanic supervisor will see what you're doing,
yeah,
and play along. Yeah. No ego, no, you know, "Well, that's a stupid question." No, it's not a stupid question. It's a duh question. I'm asking you a question I already know. I'm asking you a question that I know you know, and I'm wanting to hear it now again and again and again and again. When I start spouting this information back to you, you know that I've got it. I'm not, you know, looking for your approval so much as looking for the idea that you know that I understand this idea now. Now we both know. Now let's go team up on Jed over there who, you know, wants to learn this too. He told me before he wanted to learn it, so let's team up on him now. You know, and, oh, well, Sally over there, well, yeah, let's all three of us now team up on her so that we have this whole community of people looking to share this information with the people who want this information, which should be everybody.
I've got the biggest shit-eating grin right now. It's ridiculous. Because the other thing, I mean, that takes us into the Social Security Administration story. But let me, okay, so I want you to retell that story that we had during lunch. And I'll remind you why you told me that. I told you that I had left a book, "Revitalizing Your Language" by Leanne Hinton, in my mom's entryway, and a friend of hers comes in who happened to be in the software field, and of course my mother works with software developers and that whole agile team methodology, flies all over the world doing that, and this woman saw that book and said, "Huh, you know, I have a different kind of language problem. I have this, I think it was some kind of software system, you know, maybe a database." And she was like, "There's this language that we are all losing because new people come in and we don't know how to pass on the language." And my mom said, "Where are your keys?" And told her all about "Where Are Your Keys?" Because, of course, she's gotten an earful from me. And no, hey, man, I'm worse than you. And the woman was like, "Oh my God, you know, do you think it could apply? Now tell me the story that you..."
Not only could it apply, it applies. It applies to that. It applies to every other bit of information on the planet. It has to be relayed from one thing to another using some sort of common language. You build a common language. Well, now you both have to speak this common language. So the same language techniques apply to Spanish as they would to information databases and those kind of information systems that companies have built up over the years. But you get new employees who come in
completely savvy about data and about, you know, working the computer. But so I'm at the Social Security office, new employee, and the older employees, the veterans, they come to a little problem, and you can hear them jabbering to each other in this crazy lingo. Well, just query an F243 on that, and they get this data sheet that comes out. It looks like the Matrix. It looks like a printout of the Matrix. And they're looking at these different columns, column 3, section 2. Oh, they moved recently. They had a decrease in income. They got married in 1972, but they were divorced in 74. And there's none of this is actually written on the paper. They just know where everything is supposed to be. Now, you could, as a new employee, you could go and query that specific bit of information on the page. You could find it by column and that kind of thing. But it doesn't actually give you the ability to access the data that you need in order to make the correct decisions about whether or not to pay this person money. So they're coming in, and you've got this printout of Matrix in front of you.
Yeah.
And you need to know what happened to them 4 years ago. So then all of a sudden,
whether they're a blonde or a brunette. Yeah.
It's coded. It's an 02 or 03. Yeah. And so then bald is 01. So you take this sheet to the veteran, and they start deciphering it for you. And you sit there like you're kind of worthless at the moment, that you're not being a real team player. Like, look, I'd love to access this data. And they're all kind of looking at you too, like, look, why don't you know this? We took you on, now you're a risk, you're a liability. Like, oh man, if I could just understand the grammar of this system.
Yeah.
And what I did was I approached my boss and I said, look, you have a language problem here. You don't have a data problem. You have this language that you all you veterans have watched be built over the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
When you went from hen paper, chicken scratch, to, you know, teletype machines, to actual computers, to now the computer systems. You've watched it be built. You know where things are hidden because you hid them there.
Yeah.
You did that, right? Knowing that everybody else knew that, but not anticipating this next round of people coming in.
Yeah.
You need to have some kind of language development so that you can teach this language to new people coming in. That needs to be part of their training.
Yeah.
And they said, wow, that's great. Never happened. See you later. And I, because it won't, unless I'm already some kind of, you know, high up in the system already, who offers that as almost a transfer of their own job, not necessarily to offer it, because they realize that the value is there, but don't necessarily understand their starting point. And that's one thing that Where Your Keys really stresses is, where do we start building this language so that people can learn this language, and so that we don't just have one employee who is able to teach it, but we do this in a way so that every employee becomes a teacher of this language, so that when a new person comes in, they don't have to go to Bob, who's the IT guy in the office. They can just reach over their shoulder anywhere they want, and everybody has this same language teaching ability, so that they give this new person the language of the data, and they give it to that person in such a way that now they become a veteran data reader after they've only been there for a few months. So now when the new person comes in, it should be an expectation that they are the ones who are going to teach that new person this new language, so that the elder veteran people who are there sitting can kind of listen in to make sure it's going right.
Yeah.
But it's no longer their burden.
Right.
And that's really one of the problems with like elders in Indian languages. They're old.
Right.
They're 80.
Yeah,
you know, they don't have the physical ability to stay up for 10 hours.
Yeah.
And then imagine, like Bryce told me when I said, hey, can you teach me sign language? Yeah, but people don't stick around.
Yeah.
That happens to everybody. That happens to elders. That happens to
yeah.
just everybody. People, they come in all fired up. Day later, I got this other thing going on.
Right.
Well, that takes a lot of effort out of an elder to keep giving lesson one over and over and over again. Well, if they can train 4 or 5 people to teach lesson one, just the burden, just the time burden off of that elder to teach the menial lessons goes away. Now we can have a whole cadre of people teaching these lower lessons, easier lessons, so that when they get proficient enough, they can go back to the elder and actually get the goods. They can get the real deep information that they were looking for when they walked in the door in the first place. But that elder doesn't necessarily have time to give them the first lesson, second lesson, third lesson, fourth lesson, fifth lesson, all the way up to fluency. You know, there just isn't that amount of time.
But haha, holding back the microphone. But you mentioned that book, Leanne Hinton's book.
Yes.
She's out of UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. A language lady who did a lot of work with Krug, Terry Sapahan. And I read her book. I like it. There's a small problem with it. What her book really emphasizes is this master apprentice situation where you have an elder speaker or a fluent speaker and you have a non-fluent speaker.
Yes.
Her basic recommendation is do stuff together.
Yes.
Absolutely my recommendation. I'm 100% with her. The only problem, the thing that she kind of leaves out is the specific conversations that they should be having while stacking wood, while cooking dinner together, while cleaning the house together, while doing things together. That's great and all, but they need to have a common language. They need to have a common game that they can play while they're doing those things together. Rosetta Stone does the same thing. They have a nice outline of where you're kind of trying to go, but they don't have the specifics to empower the student to know what they're looking at and know what they're looking for, so that the language still, even with Rosetta Stone, is still being pushed on them.
Right.
They don't have this concept of like, yes, it's being pushed on me right now, but if I were to think about this slightly differently, I need to be pulling this information, and I have this database in front of me, and I'm going to fish through it to pick out the things that are important to me. I need to have a system to do that, so then I can go back into Rosetta Stone with some sort of things that pertain to me and collect the rest of the data that's laying around. So, but back to the Social Security story. Data, it's out there.
Yeah.
Companies, they have no way of talking to each other about this. So it's the same analogy as the bicycle repair shop as it is Microsoft downtown Seattle. They have a same language issue that if they spent some time on that, spent some time with their employees, letting them know that they are responsible for their own education, and this is specifically how they get that education, asking these specific questions in this order, giving everybody the same outline. Everybody is playing along as a team, not even realizing that they're part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, I'm a team player. Well, great. Be a team player.
My brain's totally exploding right now. I knew it would be too when we finally, because I've never heard. I mean, I played the game, sure, you know, but I haven't heard most of the story up to this day, and so I'm realizing a whole bunch of things. One, we definitely have to mention a pattern language. I just told you about that, and could you just take a little bit before I say my next thing and tell me how you see that this the pattern language relates to what you do.
So with pattern language, they have little topics, little catchphrases almost that explain a whole concept.
Yeah.
So like you were telling me before, lighting from both sides.
Yeah.
You tell me just that little sentence and I have this whole concept, 3-4 pages long, that explains the entire reasons and architectural background and psychological idea. But you don't have to tell me that over and over again. You have to tell it to me once.
Right.
I need to understand it once. After that, you just tell me the technique and I go, oh, sure. Great. I got that. Oh, right. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah. That will work here. Oh, we need to develop that further. And this needs to be light on three sides.
Yeah.
Or some sort of thing. So we're using that one technique. We tack on a little bit of our own personality, our own issue that we need dealt with, and then poof, we've adapted that technique to work to our specific situation.
Yeah.
Where Are Your Keys has about 100 of those techniques from Obviously. Like that's my favorite technique name. It's just Obviously.
Yeah.
We have about 100 of those. So like I said before, Obviously, two words, same sentence, same conversation, play it again, Sam. Lawyer up. I like that one. Lawyer up is one of my favorite. A lawyer never asks a question they don't already know the answer to.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I ask you questions, but I know you know what the answer is because I don't want to confuse you. I don't want to throw any curveballs at you. I want this to be seamless. I want there to be no guessing. And so when you answer that question, you also know that I know the answer. That's why I asked it. So there's no question. So you're telling me what you know that I already know that you know. So everybody knows that everybody already knows what everybody knows. And yeah, it is the same system. It is the same thing. Well, we thought about that 20 years ago. Yes, you did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, you did. I give you full credit. now use more of them.
Yeah.
Keep using them. Like it hasn't gone out of style.
Right.
But now layer more. Oh, so you know this already. Fine. Yeah. Let's assume you're using it.
Yeah.
Like a good boy, like you should be.
Yeah.
Now add on, because now you should be proficient. You've been dealing with this for 20 years. Add on some more.
Right.
Throw on some more techniques. Right. Throw on some more pattern language. Throw on some more titles, some more names of things, so that pretty soon we can have a very thick conversation by just throwing techniques back and forth at each other, concepts. We can have a whole language that is just concepts. You know, we can use pattern language from architecture, from foreign language learning, from bicycle mechanics to computer data processing, so that we can become proficient in several different professions just by having these kind of conversations.
Yeah.
Well, why can't I also be a bicycle repairman? Well, does bicycle repairing take that long? Or is it just a matter of having a game that everyone knows?
Right.
And so we can do where are your keys, bicycle repair. Where are your keys?
You're killing me.
Iced tea. Where are your keys? You know, just anything. You know, where are your keys? Lawn care.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you just play the same game, but now you just get to choose the topic.
Farming, livestock raising.
Where are your keys? Bible reading. I don't know.
Mediation.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, and just any kind of occupation that you could name, if you could apply where are your keys to it, at least you're applying pattern language idea.
So yeah.
Even within your own community of lumberjacks, you have a pattern language that you use. Everyone already has that generally. They already have sort of an office place jargon. But why not take that to kind of the next level and express that it is a jargon that everyone should know and everyone should use? Talk about that for a minute. Understand it as your own language and kind of thrive in this lumberjackness for a little bit. It will allow you to train the new lumberjacks coming in even faster. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's really my, when I came about this, my overall goal was speed. The issue was speed. We have elders who are dying. I've watched Three Languages Go since I've been dabbling in this. That's 7, 8, 9 years, depending. I've watched Three Languages Go. I didn't get there soon enough.
Yeah.
I didn't get there soon enough, not a couple years ago. I didn't get there soon enough like 20 years ago.
Right.
To get enough teachers rolling so that there's a really thick cushion of speakers before the eldest started dying.
Right.
And so I realized every conversation that you have with an elder is potentially the last conversation you're going to have with that elder.
Yeah.
Make it good.
Yeah, make it good. There's a pattern right there. Make it good.
I like it. I haven't used that one yet. Okay, so we've got make it good.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it helps.
Yeah.
If it helps.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Use it. Why not? People are like, oh, well, that's dumb. Well, did it work? Any mnemonic device, any kind of, you know, pattern recognition, storytelling. You know, the guys who have the record holders in memory. They do it with a story.
Yeah.
They attach it to some other thing. So if you can attach this different information cluster onto something else, you will remember it more. Not only will you be able to remember it, but you'll be able to move it from one person to another like a file, like a cluster of information instead of just random pickings. Yeah. It becomes clumps. The information starts to clump. Patterns start to clump. And we should be intentionally clumping things so that we aren't just thinking in isolation from one concept to another. Knowing that you are a bicycle repairman, I am going to engage our conversation. Even if I want to know something about cats, I'm going to engage you using the bicycle repair pattern so I can get to cats faster if I also know you know something about cats.
Yeah.
It's a way to have thicker, make it good.
Man. I definitely think that's one of the strengths of the game too. Is that, I mean, there's no doubt at all. I mean, to say teach a teacher, it sounds like you're gonna make it on a factory line, but you know, it's really quite a creative collaboration. You know, like, it's clear you're learning something from every student as a teacher. And it seems to me like most, or many at least, of the students you've taught have come up with their own patterns.
All of them.
Yeah, all of them. What?
I can't help that. I need that.
Yeah.
And that's really where – that's what I'm hoping happens. That's what I'm expecting happens. Yeah. Like I said, you know, in 10 years, how long does it take to learn a language?
Yeah.
I don't know how long that's going to take in 10 years. Right now, people can put an hour number on that. There's been, you know, a bazillion studies about how long it takes a person sitting in a classroom under these circumstances to learn a language up to this ability.
Yeah.
There is a faster way.
Yeah.
There is always a faster way. Yeah. I will not find that faster way. I am 100% confident that's not going to be me.
Yeah.
I am 100% confident it's going to be someone that I've taught. Someone that I have taught will get together with somebody else. They'll outthink me. They better outthink me.
Yeah.
And be able to come back with this thing. I don't know what trick it's going to be. I don't know what technique it's going to be. I don't know where they're going to steal it from.
Yeah.
And you know, it's basically this idea of working myself out of a job.
Yeah.
You know, having everyone else around me so trained and so able mm-hmm. that they start teaching me now. If I have the ability to, you know, go into a language that I have never attempted before, Chinese, in that classroom, I'm going to teach everybody around me all of these teaching techniques.
Yeah.
And I'm going to spend my time doing that front-end investment, because I know that in a couple weeks, their language ability is going to jump. And so they will be now able to teach me a variety of different lessons, because all 10 of those students have different hobbies that they like. Bicycle repair, flying, fishing, swimming, cats. They are all going to understand a different topic. So now I have 10 teachers who can teach me these 10 different topics in the same game that I like playing, along with the teacher who's, you know, who I'm trying to actively suck the language out of too.
Yeah.
So I am developing co-teachers who, when I do this, I specify that I want them to come back and teach me.
Yeah.
I say, look, I'm going to teach you this. You got to make me a deal though.
Yeah.
Is that when you outflank me in this language,
yeah.
you got to come back and you got to teach me
yeah.
this language. Because I'm spending my time teaching you how.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I need you to use that when you're done and come back and actually give me the information.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, there's still a time crunch.
Yeah.
I don't have time to go learn Chinese, Swahili, and every other language on the planet. I'd like to.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, I don't think it's going to be possible. In my kids' lifetime, I think that is a possibility. Like, you know, the 10, 20 language child. If I brew a friendship, a community of language teachers, and that's who I end up hanging out with for the rest of my life, my kid, there is no way around it, is going to have to be fluent in several languages, because all of my peers are going to play this game with my kid. And my kid's not even going to realize what's happening to him.
Until he's probably
like 6, 7, 8, 10, something like that. And then we'll clue him in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or her. But, you know, that's really the goal, is to have all these people playing the same game. So for me, it's a little late. For my kid, maybe also a little late. But I'm hoping that if my kid understands this as well, I mean, here's my pipe dream, is that if everyone on the planet understands that playing these simple games gets massive results, everyone will start playing this game. So by the time, you know, my grandkids are in school, this is going to be a super duh thing. Well, of course we're learning it like that, Grandpa.
Right.
Of course we're taking math and Arabic and, you know, classic studies in Greek and, you know, history in Swahili. I mean, of course we're doing that. Well, okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I expected.
Yeah.
You know, African history in Swahili, you know, some sort of thing like that. And, you know, local Northwest history in jargon, you know, in languages where these ideas are birthed generally hold more information than languages that they have been translated to. So why not use that language to carry that information? Well, the trouble is our kids can't talk. I mean, they can barely talk English.
Right.
So, I mean, at least we could teach them English.
Yeah.
So, but that's really the hope, is that we cut down that time.
Yeah.
There's that time crunch. Can we do this faster? Can it be done faster? I'm working on doing it faster, and I am sure that all of my students, aka fellow teachers, are looking for ways to do it faster. And there is no way that if we're all trying to do it faster, there is no way we can't do it faster. There is always faster if we're all concentrating on faster.
Yeah.
There is faster.
All right, I got the microphone now. I got to get two of these at some point. But anyway, it's funny, too, because I have this pretty strong belief, you know, that, like, in modern people, sensory awareness is a very undeveloped faculty, you know. And yet, so is thinking, you know. So I'm like, if, you know, it's like I've got no problem. If you're going to think as powerfully and as razor sharp and at light speed and be have an absolute mastery of your thought process, if you're
surrounded by others with that same expectation,
right? And that's a culture of people, you know. And if you're gonna, and then like exhaust your brain. I mean, I've noticed at the end of Where Are Your Keys. I mean, you even choked about that. You and your friend Bryce and people staggering off and like, I learned the language, and you're like, yep, you had fun too. Come on, you know. And they pass out and on the sidewalk or something. It's like Where Are Your Keys is both exhilarating, but it can really drill you. And that's the kind of thoughtfulness and the kind of use of the mind that if you're gonna use your mind, you know. Burn it, you know, just supercharge it, which is my experience learning from people like Tom Brown Jr., really masterful mentors. You know, he teaches animal tracking and wilderness survival, and there's absolutely a Where Are Your Keys of animal tracking, I'm realizing. He has names for things, you know, Wisdom of the Marks, he's, you know, the Four Gates, track math. I mean, he has all these a whole immaculate language and order, just like with where exactly. And I'm realizing that when you are saying, okay, I'm going to make myself obsolete, you know, I want them to learn, but this is a, you know, I want the students to teach me. But I'm realizing that, no, that's yes. Yes. And that is the natural place for elders of a culture to end up. You know, or at least, you know, masters of a skill, maybe. Maybe that's a more accurate way to say it. And where you are get so good that you have the ability to learn from all these students who are U-turn-made teachers. And there's, you know, Taoist remarks about that. From one thing, learn 10,000 things. And so this is Where Your Keys is learning how to learn, you know. And there's no way to pull apart teaching and learning because you're either teaching yourself or you're in school not learning anything.
Sorry about that. Yeah, keep the tuition dollars rolling. Sorry. Yeah, this is where we get a little sticky here, a little toe-stepping. So imagine if every student who walks into every class before they went to university, right, they give them a success in, remember the success in college class,
yeah.
Right? It's in every community college handbook, right? Why not give them, this is how you learn class. And there's a lot of talk about like learning styles, you know, well, I'm an auditory learner, I'm a visual, like all that. Great. Absolutely. Mix it in. Of course, use all of them. Don't fixate on one. Use all of them. Know what your strengths are. Use them all to your strengths. Use them all to your ability. Expand as much as you can on every single one. So where does that put a student who has his first day of college and is on the steps not knowing exactly what they're supposed to do while they're sitting in the classroom? Imagine that happening. It's going to be a little frightening, so just take it slow. Imagine that happening right now all around the world. There are thousands, millions of freshmen, college freshmen, standing at the door of the university, books in hand, not knowing that it's their responsibility to milk the teacher out of every bit of information that they're about to go into.
Why? Not knowing, but even being conditioned to not think. You know, that it's 12 years of conditioning to actually give away responsibility for their own learning. I mean, without a doubt.
Oh, yeah.
Like being beaten and sent to detention for to having any other idea about it, you know?
And that happens, you know, why isn't that responsibility and that desire put into place at, say, third grade?
Yeah.
Fourth grade?
Yeah.
You know, that's a real nice time that little kids can start being aware that they are responsible for asking the right questions. Don't ask dumb questions. There are dumb questions out there, you know, to distract the teacher, to get a laugh, to, you know, to show off in class, all those kind of things. Here's a little technique I like. Lunatic Fringe. You know that old song? Yeah, we all know you're out there. Like the microphone and everything. So the thing is, though, is that in a classroom, not only are you responsible for yourself, or in a learning situation, let's say, you're not only responsible for yourself and to be able to milk out as much information as you can from the teacher, but it's also your responsibility to ask questions so that everyone around you on the Lunatic Fringe, everyone around you who's in the same situation, in the same classroom, in the same group, they are getting something from your question as well. So you're asking questions of the teacher that you know will not only help you, but they will help everyone around you to the most efficient amount that you can. You have to think about the question so that everyone gets a bit, everyone gets a little chunk of it. And if everyone in your situation is doing the same thing, they're respecting the Lunatic Fringe. They're respecting their cohort. So they're just not selfish about it, but that they're sharing.
That's also the crazy thing about Where Are Your Keys and you telling the all about it. I start realizing why. I mean, for me, I don't worry about learning certain kinds of things. I have my own learning phobias in certain areas, you know, like plumbing. I'm totally freaked out by plumbing. But I have noticed that there's certain, like in languages, is one thing, but, history, science, like I've often been in groups where when I see a couple people, I can see we're losing them, and I'm a student. I'll ask something for their benefit just because I feel bad for them. And now you're telling me that that's a pattern. Why? That's what made it easy for me to learn, which is totally blowing my mind.
And they should know that you've got their back. And so, but they should be waiting. They should be, with bated breath, waiting for their chance to help you out. So they should be watching you at the same time you're watching them, so that everybody knows that everybody's watching, and not in like a big brother way, but like in a way of how can we do this so that everyone gets the most benefit out of what this teacher has to say. This teacher's here for a reason. Let's get the information. Let's pull it out in a community of people, kind of like Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
We're on the train ride at the end of it.
Yeah.
Well, how much did you get? Well, I looked at Mark for a second. Well, okay, we've got John chapters 5 through 6. Scott Johnson has those. We've got, they divide up books in their minds for this memory trick that they have that they can pull this out. I'd love to know it. might actually have it, just sitting on it right now. I've got the key, Fahrenheit 451. But that's how it works. You have a teacher with some amount of information. Can you pull as much of that information out of that teacher in a short amount of time into a community of people that are prepared and willing to share that amongst themselves, so that while the teacher isn't there, you still have some amount to go for? You're actually making that teacher's time the most efficient and effective use of their time. You're being respectful to that teacher by milking that teacher in that way of getting that information out into your community, using however you can your community to really solidify that information in your mind, so that when the teacher comes back, you're ready. You're ready to get more. The teacher, if they are proficient in their ability, do not have enough time to impart their expertise. They do not have enough time because they're that much of an expert, hopefully. So it will take everyone working as a group to pull their information out so that the group gets that benefit from it. That's one of the real gifts of a group effort to pull this out. And that's where language really comes in to this mostly, is that you need to have a strong group of people to keep this language alive. Bicycle mechanicking, you might be able to do that through videos and pictures, but there's this feel that you can never get off of that. You can never, like, hey, come here, Johnny, feel this cord right here. And you need to have that kind of hands-on at just the right time. It is. And so, but with a language, you need to have a thick community. You need to have several speakers in order to keep it alive, of different ages, of different sexes, of different education backgrounds, of different
professional backgrounds so that you save all of this vocabulary. And I don't mean professional as far as like bicycle mechanics versus car mechanics. I mean professional in your family history of basket weavers, fish trap makers, plant identifiers, hunters, bow makers, people who know specific skills that, that have been learned over thousands of years. That bow maker has enough information in his or her mind that they will not be able to impart it all in a lifetime. A lifetime isn't long enough to learn and then teach.
Yeah,
right. But if you have a whole community of people who are working to get that information out, chances of it living jump. Any chance you get to increase speed, to hedge your bets, to increase the community knowledge, to teach it in such a way that it can be taught again, to clump the information, to have this like a file sharing system, open source, Linux, any chance you have of developing your information in that kind of a mindset, the better off you are. It's the hedge bet of the century. The hedge bet of the century.
Okay, I'm grabbing the microphone because we've got about 5 minutes. There's obviously got to be a part two to this. But in these last few minutes, though, I do, in case there's some time between now and then, I want to ask. See, I don't know if you mind me sharing with the audience at home that that you know you're working on a nursing degree right now. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you're like looking. You have these alternative. You know, you're trying to figure out how to make a living because you just got laid off from the Grand Ron.
In a way.
Yeah.
They're in contract negotiations, if you will.
Okay, so you're
that's not gonna last forever anyway.
And at the very least, let's say. You're still struggling. You're still struggling with like where the inn is, and so I'm wondering, you know, say somebody hears this, like understands what's happening, understands, and in a sense, this is almost an early adopter issue, where you know you're someone who's come up with a schema that has a tremendous application, and really, you know. Few or no people outside yourself and maybe Bryce were there every little step of the way and really understand like it all the way down to the core. And it's just kind of sitting in you for now. And I'm wondering if somebody wanted to help you, you know, A, make a living at it or B, simply be able to spend way more of your time sharing it. You know, is there ways that come readily to mind where they could help you?
Yeah. So the nursing thing was kind of a means to an end, not really the passion. The passion is definitely languages.
Yeah.
And so I've been working for Grand Ron for a couple of years. And that has really been helpful, not only to just their language, yeah. but to native languages in general. And that's really my first goal are native languages in general. I've been using Chinook jargon for its usefulness. It's a trade language, a community language that spans and is an intertribal language between different language communities. In that way, it's sort of beautifully set up for what I do in that if you have a community language, you know, are there other languages that you can use to get your own language stronger? To help me specifically, what I'm looking for is the opportunity to go to different places where people are having trouble with their languages and showing them this game. This is how you can make your language stronger. In a couple of hours, people walk away with the idea and very specific examples and very specific practice on how they can get their language stronger in a very limited amount of time. That's really the goal. Secondary goal is, you know, if you are trying to learn a second language, if your company has a second language need, if your company has a data issue that's tied to a language block,
if you want to learn bicycle bicycle mechanics.
Yes. If you want to learn bicycle mechanics, if you're about to go into any kind of schooling situation, or if you have a group of students who are about to go into any kind of learning situation, if you are the head of the university and you have an incoming freshman class. I'm a great speaker for those kind of things, to really give kids this idea and a very clear and specific techniques for how they can make the most out of their situation, which makes their university experience better. It makes everyone's educational experience better. The teachers all of a sudden have informed students. The students have a goal. Everybody benefits from something like that. So any kind of educational setting. And for me, I am the most valuable at the beginning. I am definitely the most valuable at the start of something like this. Halfway through, you've kind of already dug your own hole. Now we got to dig you back out and set you on a new direction. So that's where you get the most bang for your buck from me. So.
Well, awesome. All right. Well, that wraps up at least this chance to get together and chat. And hopefully we'll be able to do this again sometime soon. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Well, that finishes up my interview with Evan Gardner. If that didn't totally rock your world, I just really don't know what to do for you. I'm still buzzing from how Evan was able to articulate, which something to me that amounts to a learning revolution, like the return of the ownership of learning back to the learners. In fact, to me, where are your keys? Sort of makes the idea of learning obsolete. And it replaces learning with a holistic understanding of teaching. Because you're either teaching yourself, and that's something we call learning right now, or you're teaching someone else. There's no real learning going on. There's a partnership with what you're curious about and engaging it in a really vital and interactive way. So, and I hope you'll take to heart how much Evan really could use help, and you can route any ideas or offers for supporting Evan in spreading Where Are Your Keys through my site. And you can make a comment about this podcast or contact me. My email address is mythic.cartographer@gmail.com. Also, for funding this podcast, I'd like to thank Robert, Jason, Daniel, Diana, Kirsten, Jana, Eric and Abdallah. I really appreciate the support that allowed me to pull together the resources to bring Evan in. And here's looking forward to the second half of the interview. So I'll catch you next time. You've been listening to the episode 23 of the College of Mythic Cartography podcast, recorded on March 3rd, 2009.